Welcome back to Silk Flowers and
Paper Mache Hearts. This is your host, Eric Hart.
And Ashley Flowers. And this week we are joined with Natalie Taylor Hart. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
She's a scenic designer, but she also has quite the prolific props resume, having worked throughout New York City as well as a few summers at Santa Fe Opera.
Yeah, we've been wanting to have a scenic designer on the show for a while to talk about the collaboration between designer and props master. So we thought Natalie would be great since she has been on both sides of that collaboration. And since she's my wife, she's right here at home with me.
So how convenient.
Very handy.
So Natalie, what sort of came first, the scenic design or the props?
I think they sort of came together in different steps. I started out in educational theater. I did theater in high school, like many of us did. I minored in theater in college, and I was an English major in college, and started teaching high school. And when I was teaching high school, I mostly taught English, but I taught one or two sections of theater every year. And I started a technical theater class and sort of, you know, got back into it and really realized, you know, that the design was the part that was interesting to me. Then I went back to undergraduate for a couple of years to do more theater coursework, to get into, you know, a higher level graduate program. And but all that time I was, you know, I had started as very much a generalist and did everything and then was getting more specific. But I've always been a person who likes crafts. And so that, you know, the interest in crafts, you know, really attracted me to props. And when I learned, you know, how to use tools and make really, high quality things, then, you know, I kept advancing in that. And then, after grad school, I sort of went back and forth a little bit as well.
So with that, how does working as a props person kind of influence the information that you present to your props department when you are the designer?
It's sort of interesting since I know both sides. For one thing, I think I have a profound respect and, you know, I understand what I'm asking of people. I find that I try to, I really appreciate collaboration, you know, even though I do know how many things are built or how people go about finding things, I try not to dictate, you know, what process I expect because I really like the artisans that I'm working with, you know, on the prop side as well as the painters to be able to bring their expertise because they're, they're the specialists and they've worked, you know, they work in that solely where I do a lot of different things. So I like to be able to, you know, to have that collaboration. So I try when I'm describing things, I try to talk in terms of like, if I were building this, this might be what I would do, but please, you know, feel free to, you know, to adapt it to whatever you think is best. And then I went to graduate school at Ohio University. I studied scenic design with Ursula Belden and I studied props with Tom Fiocchi, and both Ursula and Tom were wonderful teachers about props, and they both really taught the relationship between scenic designers and prop masters or props artisans. And so, you know, we learned how to put together a package as a designer to give to the props artisans, and we learned as artisans, you know, what we were getting from designers and what sort of questions we might ask and what further information we needed to get. So I really, you know, grad school is really great to explore that relationship from both sides and sort of all together, you know, like one semester, I'm the designer and my peers are doing the props and the painting. And the next semester, I'm doing the props and my peers are the designers. So I try to, you know, put together a solid package of props information, to give to the production team when I'm designing shows. Right now, my main job is that I teach scenic design at Elon University, and we have two scenic designers. My colleague, Charles Johnson, is the second scenic designer, and he takes care of all the paint. And then I do all of the props. So, so I am both designer and props master for my, my shows at Elon. But being able to collaborate with Charles, we, you know, we get a little bit of that, experience.
Nice.
And do you ever find, after working on a props project and maybe getting frustrated with the lack of information, does that then, have you change the next time you work on a scenic design? Like, oh, maybe I should give this information.
Yeah. And I think that I try to do that across all the areas. You know, as a scenic designer, I'm putting together information for the props team, for the painting team, and for the technical director and their team. And, you know, as we all learn more and have more experience, and come up with strange things that we do, you know, every time's a learning experience. So I try to, try to make sure that the information is clear. And I do think like, okay, if I were getting this, what sort of information would I want? Without, you know, again, walking that line of not being dictatorial where there's no room for somebody else to suggest anything. Mm-hmm. And you sort of like, you know, and it's great when you know who you're working with as well and you have an established relationship. So you know what sort of stuff they're going to bring to the table. If it's somebody new, you might specify more. And, but if it's somebody like, I don't know, Eric Hart, who I've collaborated with before, and I know what you bring to the table, then I like to hear what your ideas are. And I like to, you know, I say like, this is my general idea. And then what materials are you interested in? You know, do you think will work best? And then when I learn what the materials might be, then I go back and like, okay, this is what we can do with those materials.
Yeah, I think we met in grad school. So she actually designed a show that I was the prop artisan on. I don't think I prop mastered any of your grad shows. But then New York, we did a show together. She was the scene designer. I was the prop master. That was 2009. So since then, I've also done a few of the shows at Elon as your props master. And then you started designing shows at Triad, where I'm the staff props master. So I've been the props master for several of those shows. So a few shows over the last kind of decade working together.
And Eric's been my boss before when I was working freelance at the Public Theater and he was the assistant props master. So we've gone back and forth as to, who's the boss.
Got to keep it balanced.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And do you find working together is just, I mean, obviously you guys have a great relationship and know each other well, that I would assume your collaboration would be the best. And working together, do you just kind of, are you constantly collaborating? Do you find it easier to work together? Is it kind of like reading each other's minds? You're like, oh, I know what you're thinking kind of here.
Yeah, I think so. And we have a lot of like at home at the end of the day, unofficial meetings. Like, for this last show that we did together, he would bring paint samples home and it was just a quick, like, I'm fixing dinner. And he's like, you like A or B, A or B? Like, A, perfect. Great. Yeah. But no, I mean, it's wonderful because, you know, not only do Eric and I have a relationship, so we understand each other and we understand how each other works, but we know, you know, what each other's strengths are. And when we were both working in props, my strengths are more crafts and upholstery. Mm-hmm. And so like at Santa Fe Opera, I was worked on the craft side and Eric worked on the carpentry side. Mm-hmm. So we always sort of said that we were the perfect team because our skills, you know, overlapped, but together we cover a pretty wide swath of skills.
One full prop shop.
Yes.
You're one full person.
Yeah.
But that's awesome.
When I was working props as my main career, which was, you know, seasonally when I was first out of graduate school, I mostly did assistant scenic design. And then at Santa Fe Opera, I worked in the prop shop. And the last summer I went there, I was the assistant properties director, or there were two of us. I was one half of the assistant properties director. And then in New York, when I first was there, I was assisting, scenic designers. And then I took a job doing corporate design for corporate events, product launches, that sort of thing. And then when the economy tanked, and I got laid off that job, I went back into props. But so my thing with props was I always wanted to be the one that you call in when you have like the one hard project that you just need somebody to take off your hands, you know? So I feel like a cheater in that way because I always liked the, you know, the one big spectacular thing instead of having to get all the right glasses and silverware and, you know, pick out the myriad of other things that we have to do in the props world. So it was fun and I had some, you know, really wonderful projects that I got to work on and I still do, at Elon, but I do get the glasses as well.
Mm-hmm. Buy the apples.
Yep.
Working with several different types of scenic designers, I've noticed that some scenic designers prefer you to communicate with them first when it comes to picking out like fabrics for couches or bigger details of design-wise, obviously. And then I've also worked with some designers who are like, no, let's like have a conversation with the director and myself. And then there's the ones that are like, no, 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 it comes to me first. And then I'll present it to the director. Mm-hmm. What is your view on that? And why do you think there are two different kind of thoughts in that? And which do you prefer to do? And does it depend?
Sure. That's a great question. I think what it would depend on for me is the director. So I think I'm fairly open about that. Most of the time, a lot of times it's just convenient if everybody's in the room and then we can say, these are the options. What does everybody like? And then, you know, we pick it out and everybody goes on their way and that's great. I think if I were concerned about the, you know, as a scenic designer, I'm concerned about the spaces that people occupy and how they move around those spaces. I'm concerned about the props. And what that adds to the show. But I'm also concerned about the overall aesthetic. And so some directors are more concerned about the spaces and the things. And so if I were concerned that, that I needed to be really careful and curate the aesthetic, then I might want to have, that might be when I want to have the first look at the swatches or the colors or whatever so that I can take out options that won't help the aesthetic before I present it. And some directors too, I think, you know, there's so many different working styles and scenic designers, we work between the two, you know, we're working between the director and the production team, you know, and with the other designers. And so you're always kind of playing both sides. And so it really just depends on the relationships that you have, with, you know, how much you need to sort of curate before presenting, how much salesmanship you're going to be doing, you know, trying to sell an idea to a director or sell a production team on doing something a certain way. So that's sort of my take on it. It would be more about like how it's presented and if I'm concerned about, you know, that our choices are lapsing over to what is more practical, but we're forgetting the overall aesthetic and the meaning making of the show.
And then also with that, I know there are some designers that, you know, the small hand props, maybe like the silverware or the cups or something like that, that designers like, I don't care, talk to the director, they just leave me out of it. How do you feel about that kind of approach?
You know, I think that it's my job to care about those things, but in my experience working with, you know, lots of production, you know, professional production teams, I think that I have high standards, but their standards are higher because, you know, if they're doing the painting or they're doing the props, they want to put out a good product. So I think that, I don't like to micromanage. I like to empower the people that I'm working with to bring their best work And then if there's a problem, if something doesn't work, then I step in and say, you know, hey, can we take a look at that again? But, and a lot of times, you know, if there's sometimes depending on the show, I'll say, okay, director, you know, here's the three chairs. And if you need to move it to make this scene work, great, move it and we'll work around that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, there's a banquet scene and we talk about, you know, just the general levels of how expensive, how, you know, what period, whatever. And the prop master is probably going to make some great selections because they're the expert on, you know, the glasses in the certain period, you know. And if I need to do that research, I'm happy to do that research. But a lot of times they're the experts in that already.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess from the other side, what are the things that you're looking for a good production team or props master to bring to you as they're doing their process?
I think communication is so important, that, you know, we know what everybody's thinking and, you know, and where the problems are. I like it when people share with me, like, this is going to be hard or, you know, or this is no problem. And so I'm kind of, you know, making sure that we're putting our energy where the most impact is going to be. If, you know, if we're working with limited resources.
How do you feel when there's questions on a rehearsal report that are sort of between the prop master and the director or the stage manager? How do you feel about being like CC'd on those responses?
Oh, I like to be CC'd on everything because I want to know what's happening, you know, and maybe a lot of the time it's like, okay, great, that's fine. But then it gives me that opportunity to go, oh, you know, maybe I need to step in here or this is going to change something that we're talking about. So yeah, I definitely want to know everything that's going on. So, you know, clear communication, keeping everybody in the loop. I try to CC, you know, like I CC the production manager on absolutely everything so that they can, you know, there's someone else in the loop. I think it can be problematic when there's lots of, you know, secret conversations between two entities and that communication isn't getting back into the mainstream. I love for props masters and props artisans to say, okay, this is what you said, you know, this is what was in your packet, but we have this idea, or here's a way that we could approach this. And a lot of times that's way better, you know, because a lot of my job is, you know, I'm researching, but I'm also imagining things from thin air. And props masters have their things, or they know what's available, and, or they've done a similar thing on another show. And so they can bring, you know, that expertise. One of my big pet peeves, I guess, and this is more, it certainly applies to props, but it's about painting too. So a lot of times in smaller theater, you can be hired as a scenic designer if you can build the set yourself, or you can paint the set yourself, or, you know, all of the above. And that's such a disservice to our colleagues in those fields who have trained to do that. And it's not, you know, painting is not part of their job. It's their whole job. And they can, they can do something that is, much more, expert and nuanced than what I can do because I learned painting is just part of my training, not as my main focus. And I think that applies to props as well. A lot of scenic designers, I'm sure, would be capable of propping a show, but that's not nearly as fulfilling as when you can work with somebody who's an expert, you know, and then that's what collaboration is. We didn't choose to be, you know, like visual artists that are, you know, doing a painting by yourself in a room, you know, even though a lot of, scenic design happens on your own, I'm still a collaborative artist and bringing it, about is about that collaboration. I don't want to do it by myself.
Right. And I know working with you, one of the great things is I could send you in progress pictures and things like, this is where we're going with this. What do you think? Yada, yada. Which I find there are some directors and even some designers, if you show something in progress, they freak out because it's like, is that the color it's going to be? It's like, no, that's raw wood. We're going to, this is the step in the process like, before we get to the paint because we need to make other decisions.
Right.
Do you ever find yourself working with directors like that, where some directors you have to show a final product, but others you could kind of bring into the process?
Yeah, I think everybody sort of has their own way of, you know, dealing with it. The relationships can be so specific, but I definitely can relate to, you know, when I work in props, when somebody wanders through and like, is that what that's going to look like?
Oh, I you hate know, that.
Yeah, don't prejudge what's in process. But I also like to be able to show directors work in process. You know, again, I think it's important that you have to create the context. So I want to be able to say, you know, this is what it is and this is where it's going. You know, if you can imagine that, let's talk about it. But if you really can't until it's more finalized, then that's fine. And we'll talk about it then. So yeah, I've seen that before. And then, yeah, I like being able to present things in the right frame so that you're, I mean, cause that's what I do as a designer, you know, like my work is not a snapshot. I always kind of start with like, you know, house lights go down, blackout, you know, that's where my job, well, my job starts pre-show, but, you know, I talk to my students about even though I'm not a performer, my work is a performance. My work is still, part of a performance that happens over time in a space, in a location, you know, with a certain group of people. And I think if you look at it like a pretty picture, then, you know, you have to make sure that that picture continues to change and delight and inspire and, you know, be interesting to people over the 2 hours or whatever it is that they're going to be watching it. And that can be done with changing scenery or changing props or changing the environment. Of course, our friends in lighting do a lot of that work in changing it, but it can also be done by the way that the actors treat the space. And so I want to be involved in all of those decisions because the way that everybody is treating the space that we're in is part of, you know, is part of my artwork, is part of what I do.
So recently you guys just worked on a show together and were in a review and it was really cool. And you guys made a car. So like, let's talk about that for a moment because that's insane and awesome.
Sure. So I was the scenic designer for White Lightning at Triad Stage. This was the second performance of White Lightning. It premiered at Alabama Shakespeare Festival. And we started from scratch with it and envisioned this whole cool world put into the thrust space in White Lightning. And the way that the show is written, so it's about the beginnings of NASCAR coming from the moonshine industry in Alabama in the 1940s. And as I've reminded people many times throughout the process, it's a show with a car in it. You can't really get around that. So the director, Sarah Hankins, and I started talking from the very beginning. In the script, the playwright puts out there that the play could be done without a car at all, you know, or a fully realized car, anything in the middle. And so, you know, so that's one of the first things that we started talking about was, you know, so there's a car. What does that mean for us? And we decided that, you know, to not have a car at all felt for the degree of production that we were planning on. It felt like kind of the cheap way out, you know, like it would be a little disappointing. But our goal with the play was that we wanted to steer clear of nostalgia. We really wanted to emphasize the danger of, the people who were involved in moonshining, because it was, you know, I think it's easy to look back on that if you're from, you know, this area or, you know, Appalachia where that was happening. It's easy to look back with a nostalgic lens, but the people that were doing that were doing it because It was their means of survival, and it made economic sense. It was easier to get corn down the mountain in the form of moonshine than it was as corn. You know, and Sarah, the director, rightly likened it to the opioid crisis that we have now, with communities, you know, in similar problems. They're having economic issues, and it's just easier to sell opioids than it is to, you know, try to kind of swim upstream to you know, take advantage of other opportunities. So anyway, so we had this subject matter on our hands that's very serious. The play is very funny at times. It's a love story. You know, you go through a lot of moments in the play. Each scene, I think the maximum number of people on stage at any one time was 4. There were five actors in the show. So the scenes by themselves were sort of, you know, they could be, you know, I call them like acting scenes where it's, you know, two or three or four people talking to each other. And then there are these transitions that take us a little bit into the world of the racing. So I say all this to kind of set the stage, or this is the context that we started talking about the car in. So I wanted to abstract the car so that people wouldn't get hung up on the details, you know, like my granddad had a car that looked like that, and you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, and in the play too, you know, the car starts out and it's old, and then they fix it up, and then they put a sign on it, and then it gets muddy, and then they put another sign on it. It's like, we're not going to do those scene changes, you know, in a thrust space. We're not going to, I'm not interested in that degree of reality. That degree of reality is not helpful to the story that we're trying to tell here now at Triad Stage. So I wanted to abstract the car so we could ignore all of that and not have to do those real changes. We'd talk about them, like, I have the sign for the car, but it wouldn't be there. So we designed this abstract car-shaped sculpture that the audience was able to project their own ideas on and their own emotions on. And, you know, as the play moves forward and the car changes, I hope that people were able to feel those changes without anything actually being done to the car other than the way that we treat the car and talk about the car and light the car. So that's kind of where I started. And I had some research. I bought, I think probably the most key thing was that I bought a model car that was the right model. Because it's, you know, that period of cars really specific, and it's really, you know, complicated curves. So it's something that would take a lot of super high level drafting to be able to describe, or I bought the model and then they can hold it in their hands. And we cut it down to another of the issues was that, the real car would have taken up so much depth on the stage that people wouldn't really be able to walk around it. And so we did some modifying that way as well. And then, so I was kind of struggling with it. I had, you know, I'd drawn the car and I wanted to cut out things. And then one evening I was working on it and just, you know, struggle. And Eric said, you know, well, the way you're talking about it, you want it to look like it's fast and stuff. So, and he like drew three lines on my picture and I was like, yes, that's it. You have solved it. And I think that's where the strips came from, that the outer surface of the car were strips that were painted to look like steel, stainless steel.
Yeah, and the strips sort of had gaps in between them. So it looked like, so she had some research images sort of from the very beginning to kind of get, you know, get it in my head, the idea, this sort of like hollow shell with a lot of translucent areas so you could see light shining through it, but just enough to kind of establish the shape. Because it's a 39 Ford coupe, so it has distinctive fenders, headlights, a grill. It's like you just need a little bit of that and you can tell that it's a 39 Ford coupe. And so it was like I felt like I was on the same page, and then she was kind of, you know, she had some more research and she was kind of drawing it because she had 3D scanned that model and trying to draw on it. And I was just like, this, I think this is where you're going with this. It's like, it wants to look fast. So it should look like a motion blur of the car shape, you know, all these strips, you know.
And I was like, perfect.
Back to front. So
thank you for saying the thing that being inspired by my words.
Right. And then it was awesome. Like, I mean, I kind of told her, you know, this is going to take like months to draft. And even then, you're not even sure that the materials are going to look like that. So it was this real mm-hmm. back and forth of like, now we're going to, you know, build a frame out of a quarter inch pencil rod. And now we're going to, you know, start cutting strips. Here's a sample, like figure out the width of the strips and the depth and the paint treatment and how they're attached. And then kind of it was because it was a lot of seeing what the materials would do while keeping in mind this sort of general research image. So, you know, if we had... She could have spent a lot of time drafting it out, and then I would have been extremely frustrated trying to match the drafting because the materials weren't doing that. So having this kind of back and forth.
We made a lot of discoveries in the process. Like, you know, the middle part of the process, there were probably like two decisions per week or something. And then towards the end, it was more. It's like, so I carved a car for the model. So in quarter inch mm-hmm. scale, and I took a paint pen essentially and drew lines on it to sort of replicate what I wanted the strips to do. But then we learned in the shop that the strips couldn't do some of those things because the way that it would go around the curve after it goes around the curve, it would do a different mm-hmm. thing. So, you know, it was then sort of like a two or three times daily thing of either I'm in the space and they're working on it or he's sending me pictures and says, you know, this is what this is doing. Do you like that? Or do you, you know, here are the options and back and forth. Yeah. Cause that it would have been, you know, I think I said when we were about to finish it up that having built this car, we were now qualified to build this car mm-hmm. to start over building the car. So like, you know, if this were going on to Broadway, they would, you know, there would be all these complete, you know, down to the detail draftings, but mm-hmm. that would be based on a lot of modeling and building too. And we were in a more compressed time frame, you know, so it was best and I was comfortable with it, trusting Eric and his team to, you know, take that. And it was important for them to know too, the meaning making and the artistic and the aesthetic decisions, you know, that were going behind. Because so like if I tell to the people that are working on, you know, my ideas, building props, especially abstract ones like this, if I just say, mm-hmm. here it is, build this like this, then that's all they have to go off of. So I really like to include them in how I got to that point and what the goals are. I think I often try to talk in terms of goals, you know, like my goal for this is so that they're able to make the best decisions and they don't have to come to me for all of the minute decisions. And I know that as a, you know, from my background in props too, there are just like thousands of decisions that you make from this goes here to what piece of tape do I use, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. And so mm-hmm. if you know the goals and you know the, sort of all the origin of what you're trying to build, you can make appropriate decisions. If you only have a drawing and, you know, without that background information, then it's more guesswork or more going back to the designer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know with this, you were one of your goals was that the outside surface was absolutely flawless, that, you know, so we couldn't screw the strips in or like, you know, have any sort of attachment that would show up because we wanted this like, you know, pristine curve that's painted steel. So that was always a, you know, every step of the way, anything that I'm kind of showing is like, I'm building it like this. These things may change, but it's still going to result in the flawless outer surface sort of thing. Mm-hmm, so there were a couple things like that. And I know it's, you know, you can't always like work with a scenic designer who lives in your house and you could just bring things
better not
home. But it felt a lot more like, if you've ever, you know, if you've a lot of visual artists, you know, that are doing large scale sculpture, they have entire teams. So it's more like a team of people with like a concept on one end, or like films where they have a concept artist and they draw this illustration. And then you have, you know, sort of filtering down with, design decisions being made in terms of actually actualizing it, as opposed to just like, I know there are props people, and there's certainly shows where it's warranted, where they just, they want everything dictated, like down to the precise molding that should be chosen. And they just want to basically, you know, turn a drawing into a real thing without any sort of, design decisions. But I think with this, you know, this was a lot more than a prop. This was, I mean, scenery was also involved because there was automation and it, you know, moved around and stuff. And it was basically like, that was it in the middle of the space. You know, you take it away and you kind of, you have a couple surfaces, but this was like the visual element that changed everything. So it kind of warranted a different way of working.
Yeah. Well, and I, you know, in general, I'm less interested in realism than I am in abstraction. And I think that if you're dealing in realism, then it's way easier to say, just build this thing, because it's a thing that we recognize from our world. You know, it's a chair, it's a table, whatever. But when you're dealing in abstraction, then you don't have that, you know, that background, and you have to have more invention involved. And that's where the collaborative process can really be helpful. Or it's like, I'm trying to invent this thing. This is what I know about it. And then other people on the team are like, oh, this is what I can bring to this thing.
Yeah.
Like, great. Okay. And then, you know, we move forward, but we're making something new that doesn't exist. And so you know, there are going to be discoveries in that process. And I love, you know, I love what we do and letting those discoveries happen. As a designer too, there's things sometimes that I'll be talking to a director, and, you know, we'll talk about something and I'll say, you know, I think you need to discover that in rehearsal. And, you know, you try to set boundaries around, like, you know, here are the things that we're going to pin down, and here are the things that we're going to like give a little time to so we can work it out. But it makes sense that you need the actors to be collaborators on creating what that thing is, you know? And, you know, so there are those opportunities for everybody on the team to be a part of stuff, especially when abstraction's involved. We have to give a shout out to Victoria Ross, your apprentice.
Of course.
Who built so much of the car.
She actually did the bulk of the actual construction. Even though I talked about it, she was in the back for 2 months figuring everything out and showing up with this nearly complete car.
That's awesome. Well, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you guys for listening, and thank you, Natalie, for sitting with us. We will have you back on the show for next week.
Great.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter at SilkMache and email us with any questions or ideas for future episodes at propspodcast@gmail.com. And make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify.
And check out our website at silkflowersandpapermachehearts.com, where you can find all of our old episodes, as well as a link to our Patreon page. With Patreon, you can sign up to donate a small sum on a monthly basis to help support this podcast. And if you donate over a certain amount, we will thank you personally at the end of every episode, just like we will thank Jay Duckworth for his support.
This has been another episode of Silk Flowers and
Papier-Mâché Hearts with your hosts, Eric Hart
and Ashley Flowers. We'll see you next time.
Goodbye.